All right. Get it, because this is really the secret of the whole thing. If you see that, now, we want to go on and be able to answer all the people who will come and bug us about it. Because whether you say anything about it to other people or not, people are going to bug you about this. And then say, oh, no, 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 no. You really are something. You know, you'll know it. Oh, wowee. You know, the life isn't the way you think. It's going to be awful, see? I mean, real. Ooh! And they'll say, oh, you can. Where in such a philosophy as this is there any basis for the love of one's fellow man? For joy in children, for cultivating gardens, for doing this and that and the other, see? Well, I say, there is no basis in it. That's the same way there is no basis in emptiness for form, or so it seems. But only precisely to the degree that you have discovered the nothingness that you are, you find you're suddenly full of energy. That is energy. It's the source and origin of energy. So that when, you know, there's sort of nothing in your way, then you can do exactly what I was describing as having this glee for going into doing this, that, and the other thing and being thoroughly creative. But you can't be creative out of just plain somethingness. You need nothingness to be creative. And that's what we are. And this, too, is real nothingness. And I'm saying it's not darkness. It's not like being buried alive forever. It's not like rest. Even when the Catholics sing, rest eternal, grant unto them, O Lord, and let light perpetual shine upon them. This isn't rest, because it isn't motion. Neither motion nor rest. What is it? Nobody can imagine. And it's at that point you see where the imagination completely runs out and stops. There we've hit the thing. See, there you are, right at the fundamental mystical reality. Now, what this is we're talking about is what mystics have quite often discussed. This isn't read very much. It's a state called agnosia, which means unknowing. There's a book called The Cloud of Unknowing, written by an English monk in the 14th century. But it's based on another book called Theologia Mystica, which was written in the 6th century by an unknown Syrian monk who used the name of Dionysius the Areopagite. It's absolutely fascinating, very short little book, which I translated long ago, back in 1943. And I'm about to reissue it. But this book ends up with a description of God, which is all in negatives. Not any kind of anything you can imagine at all. Not light, not power, not spirit, not fatherhood, not sonship, not this, that, and the other. All the way down the line. Everything that anybody's ever said or thought about God is denied. Because God is infinite and therefore beyond the reach of any conception at all. So he says that anybody who, having a vision, thought he saw God would not have seen God but some creature that God has made that is less than God. So again, you approach in a Christian context. Said in such a way that even St. Thomas Aquinas bought it. That you can't impute heresy to it. Because everybody's got to agree that God is the witch than which there is no witcher. And this guy spells it out. So in the same way you get Nagarjuna saying that the ultimate reality is shunyata, voidness. So Shankara gets at it. Where he says, that which is the knower or the knowing in everything can never itself be an object of its own knowledge, for fire doesn't burn itself. although it burns other things. So we never know what the Brahman is, just like the eyes don't ever see the head. If you put something there, you are stopping short of nothing, and you don't get the whole benefit of it, that's all. If you insist that there is something there, that there is the loving father at the end of the line, or the paradise garden, you are really cheating yourself. Because it's only when you have thorough emptiness and real downright nothingness at the end of the line that you get the full impact. No holds. Look, Mama, no hands. See? Now, I really think that's the simplest thing I can possibly tell you. I really don't know what else there is to be said about this whole Zen project or mysticism, Vedanta, what have you. It comes down to that, and there are infinitely many ways of evading. But what I'm trying to point out to you, you see, is the way in which you see the point by taking the line of least resistance, by facing the facts, by not super adding to truth something you contribute to it, your own business that you put up, but saying, if I follow what I conceive or can see with my senses to be reality, as far as we can look, it seems that this is sort of the inevitable conclusion, which everybody has spent endless effort in arguing about and resisting, not realizing that if they went the whole way, how splendid it would be. And that's all you have to do.
This concludes Session 6 of Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening, from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Our program continues with Session 7. Sounds True presents Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening, from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Session 7, The World as Just So, with Alan Watts.
A lecture on Zen is always something in the nature of a hoax, because it really does deal with a domain of experience that can't be talked about. But one must remember at the same time that there's really nothing at all that can be talked about adequately. And the whole art of poetry is to say what can't be said. So every poet, every artist, feels when he gets to the end of his work that there's something absolutely essential that was left out. So Zen has always described itself as a finger pointing at the moon. In the Sanskrit saying, tat tvamasi, that art thou, Zen is concerned with that. That, of course, is the word which is used for Brahman, the absolute reality in Hindu philosophy. And you're it, only in disguise, and disguised so well that you've forgotten it. But unfortunately, ideas like the ultimate ground of being, the self, Brahman, ultimate reality, the great void, all that is very, very abstract talk. And Zen is concerned
with a much more direct way of coming to an understanding of that, or thatness, as it's called, tathata, in Sanskrit. So Zen has been summed up in four statements: a direct transmission outside scriptures and apart from tradition, no dependence on words and letters, direct pointing to the human mind, and seeing into one's own nature and becoming Buddha, that is, becoming enlightened, awakened from the normal hypnosis under which almost all of us go round like somnambules. It's extraordinary how much interest has existed in Zen in the United States, especially in the years since the war with Japan. And naturally, I've often meditated on the reasons for this interest. I think, first of all, the appeal of Zen lies in its unusual quality of humor. Religions aren't, as a rule, humorous in any way. Religions are serious. And when one looks at Zen art and reads Zen stories, it is quite apparent that something is going on here which isn't serious in the ordinary sense, however sincere it may be. The next thing I think that has appealed to Westerners is that Zen has no doctrines. There is nothing you have to believe, and it doesn't moralize at you very much. It's not particularly concerned with morals at all. It's a field of inquiry rather like physics. And you don't expect a physicist to discuss authoritatively about morals, even though as a human being he has moral interests and problems. But as a physicist, he is not a moral authority. Or if you go to an oculist or ophthalmologist to have your eyes adjusted, that is so you can see clearly. And Zen is spiritual ophthalmology. Another thing that appeals very much to Western students about Zen is that they've read their Zen from Suzuki and from some of my writings and from R.H. Blythe. And these people present a rather different kind of Zen from that which you will find today in Japan. They present what is essentially early Chinese Zen from the old writings, ranging from about shortly before 700 AD to 1000 AD. And that Zen has a very different flavor from modern Japanese Zen. And so, of course, many of the people who go to study Zen in Japan disapprove of Dr. Suzuki thoroughly, and also, naturally, of my exposition of Zen, because we don't make a great fetish of studying Zen by sitting. In Japan today, they sit and they sit and they sit. R.H. Blythe asked a Zen master, "What would you do if you had only 1/2 hour left to live?" And he said, "I would do Zazen," which means he would sit like a Buddha here and practice meditation. And Blythe had given him several choices. Would you like to listen to your favorite music? Would you have a dinner? Would you get drunk? Would you like the company of a beautiful woman? Would you take a walk? What would you do? Or would you just go on with your daily business as if nothing was going to happen? In other words, would you wind up your watch? So he was very disappointed in this answer. And he said, you know, sitting is only one way of doing Zen. Buddhism speaks of the four dignities of man: walking, standing, sitting, and lying. And so Zazen is simply the Japanese word for sitting Zen. There must also be walking Zen, standing Zen, and lying Zen. You should know, for example, how to sleep in a Zen way. That means to sleep thoroughly. Zen has been described as when hungry, eat, when tired, sleep. And when the student got that description, he said, well, doesn't everybody do that? And the master said, they don't. When hungry, they don't just eat, but think of 10,000 things. When tired, they don't just sleep, but dream innumerable dreams. So in a sense, this sounds like the old Western truism, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. But that's not the same thing as Zen. A lot of people like to see if they could sum up Zen in that way, in the Latin motto of the school I used to go to in England, agedum agis, act when you act, or while you act. There's a famous story which beautifully illustrates the current relationships between East and West. Paul Reps, who drew a lovely book called Zen Telegrams, once asked a Zen master to sum up Buddhism in one phrase. And he said, don't act, but act. So Reps was simply delighted, because he thought the master had said, don't act, but act. And that, of course, would be the Taoist principle of Wu Wei, of action in the spirit of not being separate from the world, realizing so fully that you are the universe too, that your action on it is not an interference, but an expression of the totality. But the master's English was very bad indeed, and Paul Reps had misunderstood him. He had said, don't act, bad act. And you know, that is the sort of attitude that all clergy develop over the centuries. You know how it is when you go to church, if you do. So often the sermon boils down to, my dear people, you ought to be good. And everybody knows that, but hardly anybody knows how, or even what good is. The fascination of Zen to the West is that it promises a sudden insight into something that is always supposed to take years and years and years. The psychoanalysts, if you're mixed up, they tell you, the troubles you've got yourself into over all these years can't be undone in a day. And therefore it will take many, many sessions, maybe twice a week for several years, for you to get straightened out. The Christians say that if you embark on a path of spiritual discipline, you get yourself a spiritual director and submit yourself to the will of God, but you may not get into the high states of contemplative prayer for very many years. The Hindus, the Vedanta Society people, the Buddhists also say will require many long years of meditation, very hard concentration, very difficult practice, and stern discipline. And then maybe you will make enough progress in this life to become a monk in your next life. And then you'll make enough progress to enter some of the preliminary stages leading to Buddhahood. But it's all likely to take you many, many incarnations. But when this artist Hasegawa was asked, how does one see into Zen? He said, it may take you 3 seconds. It may take you 30 years. I mean that. And so you see, there is always the possibility that it may take only 3 seconds. Zen literature abounds with stories, you see, in which there's a dialogue, or what is called in Japanese mondo, which means question-answer, between a Zen teacher and his student, and these dialogues are fascinatingly incomprehensible. But it always seems to be that at the end of this swift interchange, the student gets the point. Sometimes he doesn't. I gave a book of these dialogues once to a friend of mine, who was deeply interested in Eastern philosophy. He said, I haven't